Welcome to this edition of DebtWire. I'm Hossein Dabiri, Senior Editor and Head of Court Reporting at DebtWire Europe. The UK restructuring plan process had, to put it mildly, a difficult time last year. Groundbreaking court decisions in a number of high-profile cases have given rise to a perceived air of uncertainty. And this has no doubt adversely affected the appeal of the rather new tool that Part 26A restructuring plans are. Amid the resulting gloominess over the English restructuring advisory market, any additional guidance from the courts is, of course, a welcome ray of light coming through the clouds of uncertainty. In this context, just 2 days before Christmas, English High Court judge Mr. Justice Hildyard handed down his reasons for sanctioning dual-listed cryptocurrency miner Argo Blockchain's restructuring plan, which aimed to transfer the group's ownership to its secured lender. As well as being the first UK restructuring plan relating to a cryptocurrency entity, it was also the first time a restructuring plan has been used by a NASDAQ-listed company with the express goal of maintaining the listing, in circumstances where a US Chapter 11 bankruptcy would have resulted in delisting. This judgment is notable for various reasons, including the way in which the English judge considered issues specific to the company's NASDAQ-listed status. Talking us through these issues and more is South Square barrister Matthew Abraham, who represented Argo Blockchain and has been involved in many other recent restructuring plans. Thank you for joining me today, Matthew.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So to kick off, in Argo's case, like many, the fairness of the allocation of restructuring benefits was perhaps the key issue for the court to address. This was especially so in light of the trilogy of Court of Appeal cases, including most recently Petrofac. In court, you went through a three-step approach to persuade the court that there had been a fair allocation of the restructuring benefits relative to each participant's contributions. Please, can you run us through that approach?
So the starting point, as you've rightly identified, is the test the court is considering at fairness. And that is derived from the two cases in the Court of Appeal, namely, whether the benefits of the restructuring plan have been allocated as between each class of plan creditor fairly. Importantly, you do this by reference to their relative contributions to the creation or preservation of the benefits of the restructuring plan. So now, with that in mind, we focused, at the time the plan was put together, as well as before the judge, on what we considered to be the three elements of that test. And these were as follows. So the first was the identification of the benefits. The second, the identification and valuation of the contributions provided by each creditor. And third, the determination of the value of the benefits to be allocated by reference to the contribution. So effectively, an analysis that brings the first two stages together. And looking at those stages in a bit more detail, first, in relation to the identification of the restructuring benefits, we started by drawing from the Court of Appeal in Petrofac, which calculated the financial benefits derived under the plan by identifying the difference between the day one equity value of the restructured company and the value of the company in the relevant alternative. Now, we considered that where a plan results in the continuation of the relevant company as a going concern, as was the case in Argo and as we submitted to the judge, that this would be an appropriate method of valuing the financial benefits of the restructuring. We sought to show that this analysis would really find the intrinsic value in the company. Now, the position may be completely different where the company is in wind down or is seeking to avoid costs of an insolvency process. And we've seen that this was the case in one of the previous cases, such as Chandler's, where the court identified the restructuring benefit as the saving of the cost of a pre-pack administration. There may also be other ways of analysing it, and each case will have to be seen and taken on a case-by-case basis. Moving then on to the second stage, and that's the identification of the valuation of contributions, we again drew from the post-Petrofac case law to identify a non-exhaustive list of what could be a contribution and how such contribution is to be valued. So the starting point in this regard was always the writing off of debt as a contribution. Now, we know from Petrofac, it's paragraph 138 from recollection, that even if a debt is out of the money in the relevant alternative, it still contributes to the generation or can contribute to the generation of the restructuring surplus or benefits. So that's one of the contributions. Another aspect, which was very relevant to Argo, was contribution of assets to the company or new money. And those are elements that need to be factored into, valued, and then taken into the overall analysis at stage three. We also know that the court can do this weighing of analysis from the decision in Chandler's, and that includes noting the differences between the types of debt being written off, whether that be a secured debt or an unsecured debt, including also if that debt is under the water in the RA. So although we've moved away from the out-of-the-money analysis when comparing debt, it still may be a relevant factor. It's not completely removed. Ultimately, you can stand back and apply a critical analysis on each of those sort of contributions in order to produce what we did in Argo as a plan benefits report. Now, that can be something that's done as an expert opinion, or it could be something that is done just by the company. It will depend on each case. A final factor, and this is what's known as sort of soft contributions, which is still worth noting but difficult to value, relates to critical expertise. And in Argo and in other cases such as Madagascar Oil, this has always been seen to be a relevant contribution. But again, it's difficult to value that, and it may be just one of the factors that go into the mix. So once you've identified those contributions and made an attempt to value them, the third part, as we've said, is the analysis of whether the benefits are fairly allocated. And this effectively is in most cases, a straightforward numerical calculation between stages one and two, plus overlaying any soft contributions that it's difficult to value insofar as there's any differences between the outcomes. So that's the legal approach that we took.
Thank you for that very thorough explanation, Matthew. So then applying that test to the facts of Argo, how was fairness shown to have been achieved in that case?
Yeah, so it may help to just work through it using those three stages that we just walked through. So starting with stage one, the identification of the, if I call it the RP benefit, what we did was as follows. So the day one post-restructuring enterprise value of Argo was approximately $32.9 million. The pre-sanction enterprise value of Argo was approximately $8 million. And this was established by reference to the relevant alternative in that case, which was an administration leading to an orderly wind down. And then that gave rise to a delta, which, as I've said before, is how we calculated the restructuring surplus, as in the region of $24.9 million. And that was ultimately accepted by the court as being the RP benefit. As for the stage two contributions and valuation, there are a number of aspects to this. So first, there was an asset contribution by Growler. Conditional on the sanction of the plan, Growler was going to transfer to Argo 100% of the common shares in a newco, a US newco, which owned in the region of 16.5 million of assets, basically various state-of-the-art crypto miners and other crypto-related assets. There was a bit of back and forth over that valuation, but the 16.5 million is a very conservative outcome that was ultimately accepted by the court based on the evidence filed. Then we had a new money contribution by Growler in the form of an exit facility of 3.5 million. And that was done not by way of lending, so we didn't have issues that arose in things like Petrofac relating to interest rates being paid, but rather it was in the form of an equity injection. So that gave rise to a total asset contribution of about $20 million. Now, in the circumstances of Argo, the court was willing to accept that at its face value when we came to the analysis, which I'll come to in a moment. So they accepted the overall contribution of $20 million by way of asset and new funding. You then had the debt write-off, and this required a bit more of an analysis in order to calculate. So the evidence was adduced in relation to the notes that they were not trading at par, but in fact at 10% of their face value. So although the notes had face value of 40 million, the court held that this was the 10% deduction was an appropriate valuation to use, given that would be what Growler would have to pay in order to purchase the notes. So rather than putting it in at 40 million in terms of the debt write-off or the value of the debt write-off, the court accepted 4 million. As for our Growler's debt, the court accepted that at its full value in circumstances where, in the relevant alternative, Growler would have received 100% of its debt. So taking those into account and calculating the ratio between the two, and which I'll come to in stage three, the court calculated what the relative contributions between Growler and the noteholders were in relation to the debt write-off. I'll come back to the maths on that in a moment. We then had certain shareholder preemption rights, which were given a de minimis value because they had to be dealt with under the plan, and one could argue that the shareholders were therefore contributing the giving up of those rights. And finally, but importantly, there were various soft contributions by Growler that I mentioned earlier, expertise and others, that the court did also take into account in terms of the stage two identification of contribution sort of analysis. So that then brought us to stage three. As I say, it's about putting all of that together, stage one and stage two. And what the court did was as follows. So we deducted from the RP benefit, which we had, as I mentioned earlier, identified as being 24.9 million, the 20 million of new assets and new money provided from Growler, which the court took at face value. And that left a stub of around 4.9 million USD that was to be attributed to the debt write-off and other contributions. We then take putting the soft contributions to one side, as well as the preemption right point, split the 4.9 million amount based on a ratio between the value of the secured debt written off and the bondholder debt. So that's the full value of Growler, which I think, if I recall, around 7.5 million, and the 4 million of notes. We calculated what that was from a ratio perspective, which ended up being 65% and 35% odd, and then used that and applied that to the 4.9 million. And that gave us a new numerical position. And then we took that and found out, well, when you apply what was contributed by the noteholders to the overall RP benefit, so that amount as a percentage of the overall 24.9 million, we identified the specific contributions by the noteholders. We then used that analysis, because this was a case where the noteholders, Growler, and were getting equity, to determine what equity should be provided to the noteholders. And that's the analysis that ultimately took place to determine whether the equity given to noteholders was fair. It also was applied to the shareholders, just taking into account the fact that they were giving up some rights. So overall, that's where the court came to on fairness and accepted our arguments that ultimately the allocation was fair, as between Growler, the note holders, and the shareholders.
So given that secured creditor Growler actually walked away with less equity than its contributions to the plan would at first glance justify, the equity allocated to shareholders was akin to a gift from Growler. What did the court say about this? And also, could you explain what is the significance of this?
Yes, so that's right. Actually, when we did the analysis that we've just gone through, it became clear that Growler was actually contributing more than it was getting by way of allocation. From recollection, it was giving up on the numbers around 93% odd, but was only taking 87% odd or 85% off the equity. So there was a case where Growler was in fact giving more than it was getting back. But to put the question into a bit of context, the reason this arose and we had to talk about the idea of gifting again was because note holders took issue with the fact that under the restructuring plan, shareholders were retaining anything at all in circumstances where the note holders were not made. Now, this arises a lot in the context of the US company because of the idea of the absolute priority rule and those being paid off in full first, but also from an analysis from certain noteholders that said that the shareholders were not contributing anything. So in order to address this issue and to justify the fact that shareholders were still maintaining or retaining some of their equity, we introduced or reintroduced a concept of what's been known as the gifting principle that had developed pre-Petrofac, but we modified it to take into account the judgments in Thames and Petrofac. So Pre-Petrofac, the gifting principle focused on in-the-money creditors being able to prefer one set of out-of-the-money creditors on the basis that the difference in treatment was to be seen as a gift by the economic owners of the company, i.e. the in-the-money creditors. Now, we now know that that analysis is not a good law post-Petrofac because it relies on out-of-the-money creditors being out-of-the-money in the relevant alternative and therefore not really having any say as to how any benefits are to be distributed. However, in Argo, we argued, and the court accepted, that the principle still had some application. And we submitted that the noteholders could not argue that the share of the benefits given to the shareholders was unfair to them in circumstances where, even if less was given to the shareholders, that allocation would have been given to Growler, not the noteholders. And this was, as I said, entirely based on Growler contributing more than it was getting back. As such, the fact the shareholders were getting more was to be seen or treated as a gift from Growler rather than something that was coming from the noteholders and at the noteholders' expense. And due to this, the court accepted that there was no fairness issue arising from the shareholders maintaining their equity. We still also had an additional argument that they were giving something up, but this, along with this gifting idea, along with that, I think, persuaded the court ultimately that this was fair.
That's very interesting. As well as this more generally interesting fairness issue, the case touched on some pretty unique ones. Some of these issues arose from the fact that the case marks a number of firsts for UK restructuring plans. Can you talk us through these firsts?
Sure. So I think there are three interesting issues that arose. The first was that this RP required active engagement with the takeover panel, given it was a listed company. And there was a point in time that it was not known whether or not a Rule 9 waiver would have been passed. Some of your listeners may know what this relates to, but it really arises where there is someone that is acquiring significant stake in a listed company. Here, that would have been the case with Growler, given the amount that they were being given under the plan. So as a result of this, there was a shareholder vote that would need to have been passed to allow this to take place, and this is pursuant to what's known as a Rule 9 waiver. However, given the retail nature of the shareholders, it wasn't clear to us whether we would necessarily get that. And so there was engagement as to what the takeover panel would do in circumstances where the Rule 9 waiver was not passed. And so that was a really interesting dynamic that arose in that aspect. The second aspect was that this is the first case to involve the direct restructuring of a NASDAQ-listed company. As your listeners may be aware, Fossil also had taken place earlier in the year, but that was not through the direct company itself doing the restructuring, but in fact, another novel approach, which we'll no doubt discuss maybe later on. The third issue that arose, which was still left outstanding, was through the introduction of an analysis dependent on 901c4, but not based on the pre-Petrofac case law and Virgin Active, but rather a new interpretation of the phrase no genuine economic interest. And we focused an argument about surrounding fairness and the application of 901c4 when looking at a company's value post-RP and whether that value, when applied to the current debt stack, meant that certain creditors were out of the money. That's a point that's been left outstanding. It was introduced there and it was interesting to see how that will develop in cases going forward.
Another interesting point in this case was that at the noteholder class meeting, only the chairperson attended and voted as proxy for a number of those noteholders. This gave rise to questions as to the validity of the meeting. How did the court deal with this? And can you also say, what is the significance of the court's position in Argo for future cases?
So yes, in this case, the court concluded that where votes are cast through a single proxy, as you say, for example, the chairperson, and there is more than one member in the class, there will not be a meeting for the purposes of Part 26A. So prior to Argo, the jury had always been out on this issue. There were some Scottish cases that had addressed it, but not in England directly. And ultimately, Argo has provided the first definitive answer on the point. Now, what that will mean going forward from a practical perspective is that a plan company will always have to ensure that there are at least two persons attending meetings to avoid the need to engage cross-class cram down. Now, this won't really be an issue in a lot of the larger financial restructurings because you often have an ad hoc group in support or a supporting creditor that can assist in this process. But it may give rise to more issues in the retail context, or both in terms of the landlord type RPs, but also in general retail RPs, of which Argo was one.
It appears that Argo, together with the other recent plan which you referred to, Fossil Group, may set precedence for NASDAQ-listed companies to restructure without the potential risk a U.S. Chapter 11 bankruptcy filing would have on their listed status. In contrast to other jurisdictions, we haven't, at least to date, seen many restructuring tourists, as you may put it, coming from the U.S. to use the U.K. toolkit. Is this something we could see more of in the future, do you think?
The short answer is yes, I think we will. And maybe I'll say that, having been both involved in Argo and in Fossil, but also earlier in the year, we had Madagascar as well, which is one which related to a Mauritian and Madagascan entity. But in terms of the US, I really think we will. Both Argo and Fossil were firsts, and they provide two very interesting and novel ways of addressing the restructuring of NASDAQ-listed companies while, as you say, maintaining the listing. And we've seen in both scenarios no issue arise in the US post the English restructuring. So in the case of Fossil, it was unique insofar as it allowed a single class RP to cram down retail noteholders. Now, with the increase in the rise of LME blockers being put in place, I think we will see more US companies start turning to Part 26A and undertaking restructuring similar to that in Fossil, whether they do so using the Fossil method or they use the Argo method of direct restructurings. I do think that is likely to take place. Now, in Fossil, there was no blocker in place, so that wasn't the primary driving force, but it's a good example of how up-tiering could take place using an RP.
Just before we wrap up, over 5 years after the introduction of the restructuring plan proceeding, the English courts are trying to improve the process. And the most recent case to be brought before the court has been Waldorf Productions' second restructuring plan, in which you are once again involved, I guess to no one's surprise. In Waldorf 2, there's been talk of a mediation process, and there's been emphasis on negotiations, which is quite interesting and kind of the opposite of what happened in the first Waldorf plan. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So I think the use of mediation will depend on the type of case. So we know generally from Petrofac and before then that stakeholder engagement is important going forward. And that was made very clear in Waldorf 1. However, I think the type of engagement or its nature will depend on the facts of the case. So if you're in a world of Waldorf where there was just a handful of creditors, then a mediation may well be an appropriate way forward. There's only so much I can talk about that at this stage, and we'll have to see what the court says in the context of Waldorf 2. But I do think where there are RPs of that nature, the mediation can be a helpful way to knock heads together to get a negotiated outcome. There will, however, be still a large number of cases where this is just not possible. And this would often be the case where there are a large number of creditors. Argo is a good example where it would not have been possible to have a mediation with a whole load of retail noteholders and retail shareholders. It is not possible. However, the court will still look for stakeholder engagement. And one of the things we did in Argo, and we did it in River Island, and you've seen them in other retail RPs, is to hold town hall meetings and show other forms of engagement with investors to show that there is a back and forth. And so while mediation may be relevant in some cases, the other option may be town halls or other forms of engagement where the creditor body is sort of disparate or very large.
Very interesting. We'll surely learn more about that soon. That is all we've got time for today. Matthew, thank you for sharing your thoughts with us today. And also many thanks to our listeners. I hope you enjoyed this.
Thanks again for having me, and let's hope 2026 will be as interesting as 2025 was for RPs.